Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 291, recorded Monday, March 27th, 2017. The signals are talking. Triangulation is brought to you by Square. Accept every card for the same rate and deposit your money fast with free chargeback protection. No commitment, no hidden fees. Sign up now to get free processing on your first $500 in sales at square.com/triangulation. Some terms apply. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/triangulation. And by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they want you to try their shave set free. Just pay shipping. Start your free trial today at harrys.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the smartest, most interesting people in technology, pick their brains for an hour with your help. It's a three-sided triangle. It's our guest, of course, and me, but then you. And if you're watching it live, join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Your questions and thoughts are always very valuable. This is a good one. We're going to have a lot of fun with Amy Webb. She's a futurist, founder of the Future Today Institute, and the author of a new book called The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. And what I like about this is she actually has a methodology for futurology. Hi, Amy. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well. It's nice to have you.
Yeah.
Tell me what you do at the Future Today Institute.
So we've been around for 11 years, and essentially, we do a lot of qualitative and quantitative research, and then we have a methodology that I write about in the book that helps us define the future of X for our clients. So we've worked with Fortune 500 companies, or we still do. We worked with the last administration's White House and State Department. We are not currently advising the Trump White House.
You mean Steve Mnuchin didn't ask you before he said, oh, automation, we're not worried about that?
No, we didn't chit-chat about that in advance. Shockingly enough. So basically my job is to, along with my team, acknowledge for our clients that we don't have a definitive answer, but that we can get close and we can project out what we see coming and help our clients make better decisions in the present.
Everybody knows, if you saw Back to the Future, that the ability to know what's going to happen ahead of time is very, very valuable for any company, if you could predict, where things are going. Certainly, it's one of the things, because this is a technology network and I've been covering technology for 30 years, one of the things I try to do, but I don't have a methodology and I'm often wrong. So I studied with great interest the methodology you talk about and the signals are talking. It's a bold thing to say, I'm a futurist. I can predict the future.
Yeah, it's a stupid sounding job, right?
I wasn't going to say that. But your mother might.
It's my mother.
Honey, you're not a futurist. What's that?
It's a dumb sounding job title, and a lot of people follow that up with professional keynote speaker.
Which is not a bad job. However,
not a bad job. Yeah. But so this is it's a real profession. It goes back more than 100 years. And most people who wind up doing this professionally have a interdisciplinary background. So I studied computer science, game theory, economics. We tend to have more than one major, and our academic careers sort of bounce all over the place. Most of us who do this professionally spend the majority of our time doing really boring stuff in our office, like what you see behind me.
I love your whiteboard. I've been parsing it while you're talking. But go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of reading very esoteric academic journals or pre-publication academic research and talking to people who are in R&D labs and trying to make sense of sort of trying to spot patterns and connect dots. That's the majority of what we do. And what's interesting is that if you go back, quite a while, the rise of futurism and people's obsession with the future and with, you know, what's coming next tends to happen at around the same time as brand new tech, like big game changing technologies hitting the horizon. So for me, it's interesting, but not surprising that as we stand on the precipice of AI, a whole bunch of people are suddenly sort of fetishizing the future, and futurism as a discipline and as a job has gotten popular again, which is great. I would love for there to be far more futurists in the world who have been trained and who know how to do this, because it's going to make everybody's life better. So hopefully I will have inspired folks with the book to go out there and learn some of the tools and start doing this.
I think it's brave of you and actually very generous of you to give away your playbook, really, because this is how you make your living. But I think it is important for people to understand that you can look at what's going on, and you call them signals, and see the signals, see through the massive information to see the signals and kind of see what they're pointing toward. And it's not flying cars, I gather.
So. No. So another funny story about flying cars. So if you go, so again, like I sort of got curious, why do we obsess over flying cars, right? If the real goal is to get us from point A to point B as fast as possible with as little effort and energy as possible, why do we keep trying to make cars fly? And if you go back, the very first patent was filed in 1917 for a flying car, and we've had prototypes every decade since then.
Yeah, there was just an article this week, a new flying car.
Right, that's right. This is a brand new sounding technology that we've been trying to develop for the past 100
years.
That's right.
Well, that's right. So you actually talk about there is a signal in all of that. It's just not that's what right. you think it is.
Right, and so again, you know, we live in a very fast-paced society, especially here in America. We're assaulted with information all the time, and the challenge here is not to get distracted by shiny objects. So. And we actually had a car company that we were working with want us to figure out what's the future of cars. And I, you know, and what a futurist will do is say, let's redefine the question. Because asking the question, what's the future of cars, assumes that we will only ever get around in cars, right? So maybe the better question is, what's the future of driving?
But then that
assumes that somebody, us, right, or a relative or something will be driving whatever it is. And we already know that probably won't be the case. So instead, the question is, what's the future of humans, pets, and objects getting around, right? Uh-huh. And once you define the question that way, you're no longer constrained to what we've seen in popular culture, the Jetsons car. You're no longer constrained by drones, which is the other thing that people tend to go to. But suddenly now we have all different ways of thinking about how we'll get around in the future, which is absolutely something that car companies should be thinking about now, right?
It reminds me of the old chestnut that if the railroads had realized that they weren't in the railroad business, they were in the transportation business, they might have survived the arrival of trucking. So you need to contextualize the information in a way is it more general that we're looking for?
Right. So another challenge here is that when you're thinking about the future of a technology, most people will look at what is that technology itself.
They'll be concrete.
So you sort of, it's hard, but you have to think both in a concrete but also an amorphous way at the same time. Mm. So, part of the problem is you have to look at whatever that technology is. And its adjacent parts, but then you have to look at things that have nothing to do with it, like what's the state of asphalt, right? If you're looking for the current head of the NTSB, the Transportation Safety Board, also recently said that he doesn't think that there will be self-driving cars that don't require a human on the roads for the foreseeable future, for another 100 years. Everybody loves this 100 years,
yeah, because that's far enough you'll be dead, so you don't have to think about it.
That's right, but the problem is, you know, I have a car that drives itself, right? And it does, it just drove me back to, you know, to my office from lunch. So we can't deny what is already here, but we have to look at how, you know, advancements in this technology interplay with other areas and other facets of life, like public transit. And, you know, if you start thinking through what do automated vehicles obviate, it's not just the drivers of the cars and trucks. It's also things like the highway patrol, right? Because if we don't have people speeding anymore along the California freeway, we don't need the police people, the highway patrol people, to be there to give tickets. If they're not there giving tickets, then the people that make their clothing, the radar guns, wow, all of the other things that go with that. But think about where, if you do get a ticket, I don't know what it's like in California, but in Maryland, those tickets go to city budgets. So yes, if we have no more speeding, right, we have a huge, huge deficit in our local city budget, which is, you know, could be insurmountable. So that's why it's sort of like you can't just look at what's happening with self-driving cars. You have to look at all of these other things. And one other quick note is, you know, if our current president really ticks off China in a real substantial way, you know, we have a loss of potential. We have a potential loss of components, right?
Right.
So Uber could very well self-implode because of leadership issues, but you know, it could have problems simply because Trump said something dumb publicly, and China has decided it's going to levy sanctions or it's not going to sell us component parts anymore.
It's the butterfly effect. All interlocked, interdependent, and a change here can wreak havoc there.
That's absolutely right.
So it sounds like one of the chief skills of a futurist is a great imagination.
So, yeah.
But you got to back it with data.
That's right. So I think the people who make good futurists are the ones who have the problem that I do of, you know, you start imagining and going out far in these various directions, but then there's another side of the logistics side of your brain, the process thinking part sort of comes in and says, well, now, wait a minute, how would you do that? And people tend to be better at one side or the other. And then there's this group of sort of hybrid thinkers. Those folks make very good futurists because you need both skills. And as a job, this is not the sort of thing that you do by yourself. So when you are forecasting, you always do it in a team, and you need both groups of people sitting at the table to do this together.
We're talking to Amy Webb. She is the founder of the Future Today Institute and the author of a new book that helps us all kind of think about the future in a way that's useful. The signals are talking, and I'm gonna read a little bit from this about how futurists work, and then you literally, which is very, again, very generous, have a 6-step process for predicting the future. I think this mm-hmm. could be useful to everybody. We'll have more with Amy in just a second. Our show today brought to you by, this was something that changed the world. Square. Remember the first time you saw, you went to a store and they were using Square to check out? It was like, wow, that's the future, right? I remember the first time I heard about Square, I immediately ordered the little Square card reader that you plug into your phone so I could take credit cards. Nobody buys anything from me, but I love the idea. I was swiping it, paying myself a buck. Square started with a radical idea. The more they could help businesses succeed and grow, the more they would succeed and grow. Duh. So they set out to make tools that would help every business. Actually, it's a great story. Jack Dorsey went to a makerspace and fabricated the first Square card reader. And a huge, wonderful business was born. Square. If you don't know what Square is, Square lets you take payments anywhere, any way your customers want to pay, so you never miss a sale. Square's hardware and software, you know, is now, I mean, this is a few years on, is bulletproof, reliable, easy to use, powerful, affordable. There is absolutely no reason you shouldn't be using it. The free MagStripe reader, free, plugs into the headset jack on your smartphone or tablet. But you can also accept chip cards and NFC payments with the new Square reader. That's $49. And that works with all iOS and Android devices. And actually, that's kind of the more modern way, isn't it? People just want to tap it. It connects by Bluetooth LE. You don't even have to have a headphone jack. You don't have to have a connection at all. You slip your iPad into the Square stand if you want to have a point of sale. Sign up in minutes and accept every major credit card. And by the way, not only did they reinvent kind of the physics of this, they also reinvented the payment system. They've simplified it incredibly, and this is really great. 2.75% per swipe, dip, or tap, period. 3.5% plus 15 cents for keyed-in transactions. And Square will create custom pricing packages for businesses that do a lot of business with annual revenues of over $250,000. Actually, that's not that big, right? Probably your coffee shop does that. An average ticket size of over $15. No hidden fees, no penalties, no commitments. You only pay for what you use. Don't you love that? And Square deposits your money within one or two business days. That is fast payouts. If needed, on-demand deposits cost just 1% of the total deposit amount. Square also gets your back with up to $250 a month in free chargeback protection. Yeah, nobody does that. That's awesome. Check your sales on the Square dashboard. You can do that on your PC or your iOS app. You can see historical and real-time sales data, track inventory, send marketing campaigns, create loyalty programs, and more. And then you connect it with your services that you use, QuickBooks, Weebly, BigCommerce, whatever, or use their APIs and build your own solution. And, of course, great security, great customer satisfaction, and great support for you, the merchant. See how Square works for your business. Customers love Square. I love Square. When I come in a store and I see the Square stand there with the iPad, and I go, well, yeah, this is going to be easy. See how Square works for your business. Sign up now. You'll get free processing on your first $500 in sales. Square.com/triangulation. Some terms apply. Square.com/triangulation. I think this is the first time they've been on the show. I'm thrilled to have them. Square, first ad. Square.com/triangulation. If you sell anything, even if you're a plumber and you go to somebody's house to take a payment right there, that's the best way to do it. Square.com/triangulation. Our guest is Amy Webb. Her new book, The Signals Are Talking. You start with a trip to from 1997 to Akihabara, where you saw the future of messaging. And at the time, it was like, ooh. In fact, I think, didn't the guy who showed it to you, you call him an elderly geek that showed it to you, say, this is magic. But you knew better.
Yeah. It was a real transformative moment for me at that point. I'd gone to Akihabara all the time to get components and stuff, but it was sort of a neat. I was there at the right time, and was able to speak Japanese and nice. Just got to see. Yeah,
that feels like a play. I mean, people have always told me you want to see the future. The short term, 5-year future. Go to Akihabara. That's all there already.
Well, it was a lot of Akihabara.
It's not anymore.
A lot of those stalls closed down. But
it was like Blade Runner, right? With these little shops and stores and guys with weird things looking at soldering.
It was amazing to me that entire place didn't explode. Because everybody smoked and nobody, it was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. So let me read a little bit. Futurists, this is from the book The Signals Are Talking. Futurists are skilled at listening to and interpreting the signals talking. It's a learnable skill and a process anyone can master. I need to do this. I need to take your course because we're talking about, how technology is changing our worlds. Futurists look for early patterns, pre-trends, if you will, as the scattered points on the fringe converge and begin moving toward the mainstream. They know most patterns will come to nothing. So they watch and wait and test the patterns to find those few that will evolve into genuine trends. That is that's a great description of what you do. And it sounds like fun too, by the way.
Yeah. It's fun, but I also feel, I am shocked and dismayed that people who are leaders, who run businesses, small businesses, large businesses, government people, they're all expected to know some basic skills like how to read a budget.
Yeah.
Right. And nobody is required to have a basic sort of to do basic forecasting.
That's what's unique, I think, about you and what makes this. It's data based and you're a wonk. So you look at things like asphalt and the budgets and the balance sheets. You look at more nitty gritty stuff. Where most of us are just, that looks flying car. That looks cool. We're kind of our heads are in the clouds.
There's plenty of work for us. We're doing fine at the Institute. the reason that I wrote this is because I am incredibly concerned that technology is becoming sort of instantaneously politicized.
Yes.
And it's not just within government, but it has become we have fetishized the future and we are politicizing technology. And the problem is that the people who start who are making decisions about the future for everybody else aren't tapped in enough. And so you find some, you know, like a BlackBerry, that the signals are there, right? And yet they alone can't seem to see what's coming. And this company that once had 90% market share is down to zero, right? And it happened almost overnight. A lot of people worked for that company, you know, and, you know, could they have adapted and still been around and figured out a way to push the envelope? Absolutely. But they didn't.
You know, that's a great story, because Mike and Jim, if anybody, they were right there, right on the front lines,
right.
and they completely fumbled the future.
That's right. And I, you know, I don't know them personally, but my observation of what happened is oftentimes when companies are doing well, you know, or you've got a startup and you're doing well, that's the most dangerous position to be in.
And frankly, more often than not, that's when people flop, right?
That's right. Sony is another, I go through a big explanation of Sony in the book, but here's another example of, and people who watch the show and listen to this, they know, you know, the decades of irritation that Sony caused.
Yes, they were the number one consumer brand in the world.
That's right. No
baloney.
That's right. And, you know, and in Japan, you know, Sony is a revered company. So what happened? How did they succumb to this unbelievable
hack? What did happen? Let's use them as a case study. What happened?
So again, what happened is a lot of these companies treat any change as a novel one-off. So Sony was breached multiple times over a decade, and each time it was treated as though it was a one-off. And they weren't paying it. And this is why you have to pay attention to other signals. So, you know, outside of the company, you have the American economy, which isn't doing well. You have a sudden gust of people not sort of anti-corporate mentality, right? So you have these pockets of activity where people are pretty unhappy, and you are, you know, you are, whether it's DRM or, you know, any of the other restrictions that Sony has tried to push through or suing people, you know, it was basically just whacking at a bee's nest, right? Over and over and over again. And when one bee comes out of the bee's nest and nothing else happens over a period of time, fine, that's a novel one-off bee. But if you see a trickling of bees coming out every time you whack that bee's nest, that should indicate a pattern, right? Maybe don't tick off the bees, because they're all going to come out and sting you, right? So this is a challenge that so many companies face and our government faces, and just individually as humans we face. We get comfortable in the present. So this is something we call the paradox of the present. It's where either you're doing so well that it never occurs to you that things might change, or you can't see beyond what you currently know to be true. And everything else either sounds like science fiction, or it sounds like novelty, or it's frivolity, or, you know, whatever. You shouldn't waste your time on it. You know, and oftentimes people are looking at the wrong thing. So if you go back a couple of years and look at Foursquare, Gowalla, and Scavenger. Right?
I don't even remember Scavenger. I remember Foursquare and Gowalla.
Scavenger.
And Google Latitude. Throw that one in too.
Oh, sure. So, you know, this notion of checking in and earning a badge, that sort of game layer, you know, it was pretty clear that was never going to stick around. But location-based services, right?
Right.
Would, absolutely. So the companies that chased, and the investors and the people that chased the badges, that side of it didn't do well.
Right.
Right. All that whole ecosystem collapsed. The people that chased the back end did
location,
you know, well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the same could be argued now for Snapchat. Everybody, you know, every adult that I know over the age of 30 loves to hate on Snapchat. And again, it's not, you know, you have to stop and think about what's happening. What's the thing to be paying attention to?
Tell me, I want to know.
Right.
Is it about instant messaging? Is it about destructive messaging? What makes Snapchat so great? And is it a good thing going in for the future?
Right. So again, Snapchat itself is a company. Will it be here like Nintendo and IBM are 100 years hence? Yeah, probably not. But what's important to pay attention to is how it changes the behavior and the communication styles of people. So having ephemeral, right? So ephemeral messages that are primarily video based, you know, is this generation's modern way of, you know, the younger generation's modern way of communicating. My generation was emoji.
Right.
Right. So, and before that it was text, and before that it was email, and before that it was fax, and before that it was, you know, handwriting letters.
We used tin cans and string in my generation.
Yeah, of course.
So that's interesting. So, clearly Instagram understood that, because when Instagram added stories, it was an instant hit. And they understood it was ephemeral and video. Those were the key things.
Right. So what do you do? You know, depending on what you do for a living or what you're interested in, you know, Snapchat is a smart short-term bet. But the, you know, thinking like a futurist, we practice elastic thinking. So we're thinking in the short term and the long term at the same time. So I would pay attention to Snapchat in the short term. But more importantly, what are the second, third, fourth order innovations that spin off from this back end technology? You know, at some point, think about ad exchanges. So one of the clever things about Snapchat is the AR filter, which is powered by recognition.
Yep.
Right. So if you can recognize a face in a picture, you could recognize me holding a coffee cup or something.
Ooh.
Right. So if this is a Starbucks cup and let's say there's branding on it, you know, that becomes an easy way for Snapchat to make money.
Do they do that? And
not yet, but so
you predict they will.
It's from data, because I don't predict without data. No, I saw a bunch of their patent filings where they talked about a totally new kind of ad network that's based on image recognition. But if that's what they do, right, then there'll be a new layer of ad types that are built, which then changes the way going forward. You know, it helps boost AR and it helps boost, you know, monetization, like in different ways. Uh-huh. So,
but as you pointed out with Uber, is that there are external, unpredictable sometimes external forces. For instance, Snapchat may realize that people thought that was an invasion of privacy. And as much as that's a great idea in those other respects, users were going to reject it. You have external forces that you can't always predict, right?
That's right. So, and Uber is a great example of a company that everybody wrote off, and then suddenly they were successful, and everybody was trying to come up with their own Uber of X. Right?
Yes, you have a list in the book of a whole bunch of real Uber for X's that are kind of silly a little bit, you know? Uber for drones, Uber for medical marijuana, Uber for trucking, Uber for private jets, for ice cream. We pulled up the website. There's Uber for snowplows, plows, Uber for lawnmowers, mows, and Uber for leaf blowers, leaves. That's one company.
Yeah.
Crazy.
That's right.
Is that a signal? What's the signal there?
So the signal there is Uber itself the trend, or is the Uber for X thing the trend, or is it something entirely different? And this is a challenge. This is a good example because it's really difficult. Uber itself is a successful company, regardless of what its CEO is currently embroiled in.
They're surviving it, which is, you know, telling, right?
They're surviving.
They can have self-inflicted wounds all over. Worse than St. Anthony, but they can still survive is a testament to the idea.
That's right. They're surviving for a couple of reasons. One, their back end system is incredibly smart.
Yeah.
And we continue to use Uber in spite of threats of boycotting or deleting the app. Every year, you know, around big tech conferences, people will post about how Uber is price gouging. But the only way that they would even know that is if they had taken the trip. That's how you find out, right? The people are content. So in spite of ourselves, we continue to use the service, which tells us something, right? That's interesting to pay attention to, but now you have to sort of think about what else is that company doing? Well, they poached the entire autonomous car department from Carnegie Mellon. They've bought mapping companies. They've made investments in all of these other areas. So, it's clear to anybody who's paying attention to that they are working on becoming a invisible layer of logistics that powers our everyday lives. So if you think of Google being the invisible information infrastructure layer that powers our everyday lives, you know, to me, it's not inconceivable that at some point, you know, Uber is the package delivery service that unseeds FedEx and
DHL. Yeah, because they got people driving all around.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes the service that takes me and my pet and my kid and my grandma to point A to, you know, from point A to point B. It challenges and perhaps replaces all of our public transit inside the city, you know, systems. But again, if you take this many more steps out, why doesn't it become the thing that powers farms, right? I spent some time on a potato farm and then at a potato chip factory watching everybody and how the different things work. And most of those people could be eliminated through collaborative robotics, which already exist, right? So if we have collaborative robotics along with a underlying system that feeds logistics, you know, and a transit system that can move products back and forth, you know, a lot of that potato chip factory is already automated. We really don't need, you know, a farm with 100 people on it or that are a part of it. We really need somebody who understands agriculture and is trained in computer science to, you know, who can deal with small errors and sort of fixing things and maybe overseeing certain things. But the rest of that could be automated potentially through Uber, the, you know, potato farm service.
Wow.
So I'm not saying that that is what's going to happen. I'm saying, given what I know to be true today, these are possible scenarios that could unfold. And because we know that's true, that's why a company like Monsanto should be paying attention to Uber in a way that they aren't yet.
Wow. I want to say that you're not... You're not in a position of making stock picks here. Let's say right now, this is not a buy signal where you'd have to make your own decision at home for Uber or Snap. That's not what you're trying to do here. You're trying to see what the trend lines look like and how companies should think about them and respond to them. And I suppose too, consumers, because particularly with government and society, it's important for us to think ahead about where we're headed. And what comes up for me is our Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, who a couple of days ago in an interview with Axios said automation, job loss due to automation and artificial intelligence is not even on our radar. He said it's 50 to 100 years out. Now, there is some debate over what the job losses will be. I mean, but I think it's also... seems silly to ignore the fact that automation is already replacing jobs and that we should have a strategy as a society going forward for what we're going to do to people who are losing their jobs, how we're going to transition.
That's right. So four responses to that. First of all, I should have noted in the beginning, I don't invest in any of the companies that I've just talked about, and none of them are our clients.
Yes, good.
I would make that clear.
Yeah, this is not stock advice.
That's right. That's right. And the only reason I talked about them was because
and I know that, and I think it's important to say that. And by the way, people watch all of our shows all the time trying to get ideas for stocks to buy.
Yeah.
And that's up to you. That's on you, but we're not telling you anything.
Yeah. All right. So now the second thing is, what the hell happened, right? So
I've been saying that every morning.
Right. And I don't normally tweet storm stuff, but this was one of those things where I'm like, there's only three plausible reasons for him to have uttered these completely ridiculous words.
You think it's ridiculous? There's no justification for it.
No. So here's what I'm thinking. Either here's somebody who is, you know, here is a Treasury Secretary of our country who oversees and thinks about stuff like the workforce and the economy, who somehow has missed all of the academic studies. He for the past four decades, he missed Jamie Dimon's, you know,
even his own old company, Goldman Sachs.
That's right. That's right. So that seems implausible. It's possible, right? But it seems implausible. The other option is, he has read all of this, and in addition to being a climate denier, is an AI denier. Right. So that's the other possibility, that he's just chosen to disagree with everybody. Right.
Yeah.
And the third possibility is that the administration knows exactly the problems that we are facing in the United States, that there is no quick fix, that there is no bringing back factories. And they are towing the usual rhetoric.
That's
which
not a
is,
good way to get votes.
everything will be fine. At this moment, I should also say that I am not a Democrat or Republican. I'm independent. I voted for both. I am not irritated at this administration because they're Republicans. I'm irritated at them because of stupidity. Their stupidity.
Yeah.
And
I think many responsible Republicans disagree with Steve Mnuchin. A great many, maybe more than a majority.
That's right. Now here's the real problem, right? Because it provided at least a weekend's full of bewilderment / depression, right? Now we're laughing about it. So now that the dust has cleared, here's what's really going on. What's really going on is that nobody, you know, the average person doesn't understand that AI is not new. That in fact Descartes, you know, first talked about it, and then Ada Lovelace wrote about it in the footnotes of a letter a paper she was translating in the late 1800s for Babbage. There was a meeting in Dartmouth in the 60s where the term artificial intelligence was coined, and then we went into this winter of AI because money and funding dried up. You know, we are just now at a point where we have enough compute power, enough commercial viability, enough people who have been trained, who are working in the ecosystem, that we can start to really see some progress moving forward. But the challenge is that while this entire history was happening, everybody's point of reference is science fiction, right? Or their own invented facts. And so, you know, AI is not going to become weaponized overnight. You know, and used, you know, the sort of killer robots thing is not going to happen overnight, nor will AI suddenly solve all of the problems that we individually face. You know, a lot of the most important elements of it that will unfold are pretty boring and mundane. You know, it's like basic machine learning systems that are getting better incrementally. To be fair, there is the most widely cited study about AI taking jobs is from 2013. I think it was an Oxford study, and they said 43% of jobs will be obviated.
Yeah.
These, part of the problem is humans like to think in neat increments of time, 5 years, 10 years, right. 15 years, but technology doesn't care about that, right? The evolution of technology goes at its own pace. So to say that 50% of our job force will be gone in 10 years is making a lot of assumptions that, quite frankly, we don't have enough data on. So I would have much rather had him say, it's something that we are concerned about. We don't have enough data. We are, devoting resources into thinking about it, rather than saying something that's dangerous for the American people, which is, don't worry about it. It's not even on our radar.
Yeah, and even if... You could say the same thing about climate change. Even if it's not true, it is good for our country to train people, to prepare them for new jobs, more modern jobs. Even if every driver in the country, which is millions of people, a significant percentage of the total workforce, aren't going to lose their jobs in the next 10 years, not a bad thing to give them some training for other jobs that may be more valuable. So it's not even it doesn't seem like a controversial thing to say.
But it is, because I think that there's a tremendous amount of infantilizing the American people. I think this administration has been infantilizing some real, problems that we are facing. And I'll tell you something. So Mnuchin said that the day after Trump sat in that big rig honking, tooting the horn.
Yeah, the Mack truck. Yeah.
Right. And on that same day, out west in your neck of the woods, two self-driving trucking startups were running tests on the road, delivering things without drivers. So it's like you have to at least acknowledge that work is being done and, exhibit some curiosity. And ultimately, I think the average person who has... who is exercising their logical mind, even if they're not hip on technology and they're not paying attention to everything, I think they understand that automation is coming. So, I'm not sure what they were trying. The whole thing to me is just dumb. I was just dumbfounded. But why must we politicize technology? Why must we, constantly you know, it is a bad thing. It's a bad thing politically. The messaging is bad. But it's a bad thing for our country. You know, much better to say, we're going to investigate this and we hope that everybody will get smart about it. We're going to provide resources to local cities, you know, and we don't know what the exact numbers are. We don't know exactly when this will happen, but we're going to work together to figure it out.
Well, and it's a lot better than saying, oh, no, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Just go. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Everything's good. We're going to take care
of
it. That's the infantilizing you're talking about.
That's right. And that's just one example. So we didn't talk about CRISPR. We didn't talk about biotech. You know, we didn't talk about gene drive. There's a whole, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. We didn't talk about data. You know, there are all of these things that we are about to confront as humans and as Americans. And again, this comes back to why I wrote this book. We make bad decisions under duress. Our lizard brains take over. We lose our ability to think in a rational, critical way. And my great concern is that, you know, our increasing inability to do this because we are fascinated by technology and then, I guess, you know, allowing ourselves to politicize it, you know, is that it's bad for business. It's bad for the, you know, fractious nature of conversations that we're having between each other in the U.S. It's bad for government. And I have a young kid and I don't want her to grow up in a, you know, crazy society.
You can you can bet that business is thinking about this. I mean, you wouldn't be a good, steward of your business if you weren't doing these kinds of preparations. But they're just not preparing in a way that might be of civic benefit. They're preparing for their own company.
This is not just about civics. So we advise several Fortune 50 and Fortune 100 companies, and a lot of them are not, they're thinking about product innovation. They're not thinking about
And we have a economy that's quarterly results driven. And so you're kind of encouraged to think in the short term, not the long term.
That's right. And for me, there's no way to put an ROI. Like, how do you estimate it? Like, you're not going to know if we were right until a couple years from now.
Too late. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, that's what I have to say, one thing that we do on Twit and always have done is think about what's happening and the consequences of it and how it's going to affect us. And I'm really glad we can have you here to give us some order to what we do. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about your six-step funnel. And there's a great graphic. In fact, Carson, I'm having trouble showing it here. Well, maybe you're seeing my screen. Okay, then. It's flickering on my screen. But we'll walk through the six steps so that you at home can be a futurist. Because we all need to be futurists a little bit. And I need to be better than I am. I'm a terrible predictor of the future. Our show today, I mean, who would have predicted Blue Apron? Right? Although, I bet you the signals were all shouting this was going to happen. It makes perfect sense, right? For a while, we were all going to fast food and eating out, but we realized, I think, it's not the best way to deal with it. We're all busy. We're all stretched for time. And at the end of a long day, nobody really wants to plan a meal and shop for a meal and then cook the meal. So we end up at Applebee's or Burger King. That is not the right answer. And Blue Apron is changing that. And I love this. They're the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their goal, their mission, to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And I could go on and on. You know, Michael Pollan's written some great books about why cooking is so important to us as a society and to you as a person and to our family. But I got to tell you, this makes it easy. And that's really the most important part of Blue Apron. You don't have to shop. All you have to do is go to the Blue Apron site, pick the meals you're going to get. And it's not a subscription, by the way. You pick the weeks you want it. If you don't want it, you don't have to get it that week. And then they will send you a box with everything you need to make three amazing meals, either for a couple or for your family. They have two different plans. Amazing recipes. You'll use ingredients you've never heard of, and yet you'll become a master of using them. And this is less expensive than shopping for yourself. Grocery stores are 60 to 70% more expensive. And if you think about it, it makes sense. They've got, you know, buildings. They've got employees. They've got, you know, a grocery store has a lot of overhead. This eliminates the middleman. You're going right from the farm to you. Fresh food, amazing food, and no waste either. If you need 2 carrots, you get 2 carrots. You don't get a whole bunch. So you always have just the right amount to make a perfect meal. And man, are these meals good. I want to emphasize this. The payoff is great. The house fills with amazing aromas. The kids are going, oh, that's great. In fact, get the kids involved. Blue Apron families cook together on average 3 times more often because everybody wants to get involved in this. Look at some of these things. Spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata. Sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice. Thanks to Blue Apron, I can safely say I am a bok choy master. There are vegetables I would never try. But now, man, I am so good. Kale and white cheddar quesadillas, spice rubbed roast beef with collard greens and potato salad. Look, you're going to say collard greens. Oh, let me tell you, you've never tasted anything so good in your life. Blue Apron collard greens. Oh, and now I'm not afraid to buy bok choy or collard greens or a whole bunch of other ingredients I'd never heard of. Farro. I didn't know what farro was. I buy it now at the store because I know how good it is. Chicken under a brick with roasted vegetables and Italian dressing, garlic, chives. Oh, look at this. Oh, man. Okay, my mouth's watering. I'm going to stop right now. Just go check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with your first purchase. Free shipping to blueapron.com/triangulation. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. First 3 free, blueapron.com/triangulation. I bet you, Amy, you could have seen that these food delivery services, not just Blue Apron, but this has kind of sprung up. You saw that coming, right?
So Blue Apron itself, no. But that's not the idea. So that's an important point. It's not about predicting the next. It's not about predicting at all, because predicting would assume that there is a definitive answer somewhere. Instead, it's understanding the sort of change in human behavior and how that intersects with technology.
Yeah, and that is a clear representation of how human behavior has changed, right?
Right, absolutely.
And frozen food. We went through frozen foods and we went through microwaves. We went through fast food. And thank goodness we're coming out of that tunnel, which was so bad for us for so many mm-hmm. decades. And we're finally getting back to something that's really a healthful and I think great for our emotionally. So it's interesting to watch these things happen. Anyway, let's talk about the 6-step funnel. Sure. You start gathering information and you say you start at the fringe.
Right. So one of the biggest mistakes that people make when they are trying to figure out what's next is they are looking at the wrong information. So for us, we start at the fringe. And the fringe is that place where academics are still testing out their theories and their hypotheses and their experimenting. People in DIY labs, you know, are hacking away at something. So this is before you read about it in any of the tech blogs, and certainly before you see any information in newspapers.
You even talk about in the book about the biohackers, the people who are inserting chips into themselves.
That's right. Now, yeah. These people, you know, so fringe is sort of sometimes connotes a negative stereotype. And you know, to be fair, there's a lot of fringe thinkers out there who are doing things that probably won't ever take on or become much of anything. But that's not the point. The point is, when you look in aggregate, what does this network of people and network of information and you know, stuff tell you? And so we pay attention to scientists and technologists, but we're also looking at anthropologists. We also read sci-fi because, you know, all of that, there's a bit of interplay. And a couple of easy things people can do at home is to sign on to the USPTO. So this is the Patent and Trademark Office database, which I know does not probably did not make everybody super excited when I just said that.
There are increasingly a large number of blogs that talk about patents, right? There's an Apple patent blog that watches this. There's FOSS patents. This has become a kind of a little bit of a hobby for people, I think, to keep an
eye
on things. I always point out that modern companies patent everything they think of. Yeah. Because they're for defensive purposes, if nothing else. So it's not always a perfect indicator of what they're planning.
No, but that's actually not. So I don't use the database that way. I don't really care what Samsung is doing next.
Ah.
What I about is what is everybody chasing or working? Is everybody patenting something about AR, for example?
Aha, I got it.
In some different way, right? And the only way to know that is by looking at a lot of them.
Got it.
So, and we have a little spider that crawls and pulls in content as needed. But Cult of Mac is a blog, and they always have a lot of. And there's another one called Patently Apple. If you're interested,
yeah,
in
that's
Apple
the
stuff.
One I was referring to. The Apple,
yeah. Yeah, so looking at patents, looking at so archive, arxiv.org, is a great repository of, and it's free, of you know, academic papers on all different types of physics and computer science and stuff. And you don't have to read the entire thing.
This
you know,
is
you
cool.
Could, yeah, and it's cool because it's free, which you is hard to find.
Yeah, most academic papers, they charge you, which really annoys me.
Yeah. And I'm always advocating reading the entire thing before coming to a judgment about something. But you can read the abstracts.
You are a wonk. Okay.
Yeah. So there, you know, there are all kinds of places like that. Nearly every major company has a R&D lab, and most of those R&D labs have blogs. So Google has several different blogs. Sony's like interior. R&D departments have various blogs that are in Japanese, but you can use Google Translate to translate them. So the point is, don't wait. You know, once you've if you wait for something to show up in the Wall Street Journal or even on a place like Recode, it's too late. You want to sort of find information faster than that.
Not only go to the fringe, but go to the source materials, really.
That's right. And as you're reading, you do what you see behind me, which is to make a fringe sketch. So these crazy bubbles on the wall, this is actually me trying to figure out something about self-driving cars. Let's see if I can...
Wow, it's huge.
Yeah,
you have a whole whiteboard wall. Holy cow.
And a ladder.
And a ladder. Whole,
yeah. So that's me reading and creating what I call a fringe sketch. And there's a this is explained how to do this because it's not just drawing bubbles. But what you're trying to do is... mark down the information that the facts that you find and separate what's assumption versus knowledge, and then observing relationships. And that's usually best done in a group of people.
It's almost like brainstorming.
It is, but in a very specific way. That's the first step.
Okay.
The second step is all that does is reset you to zero.
Wow. This is a lot of work. I didn't realize this was going to be involve homework.
Well, it is. And the problem is most people will jump straight to number five.
Yeah, me too.
Which is writing scenarios, which is the cool part.
Yeah.
There's stuff that happens in between. So
no, do the research. You got to do the research.
Yeah. Anyhow, the second step is to identify patterns. And you're looking for things like contradictions. Is one thing happening when something else should happen? Are people hacking away at something for some reason? Are people pushing something to extremes for some reason? The biohacking movement is a good example of an extreme. And then those are the first two steps. The third step is, did you screw up somewhere?
saw a pattern, but is it really a trend?
That's right. And the reason for this, did you screw up somewhere part, is that we all come to research with our own cognitive biases. And so this is a way to help make sure that you're not seeing something that's not there or that you're not missing something that is there.
You use as an example in the book, the, Ken's triangle illusion?
Yeah.
Where
exactly.
It's really three Pac-Men. But because they're forming the outline of a triangle, what you see is a triangle. And so maybe that's not really what's there.
That's right. Now, philosophically, you could argue that only the triangle is there. it's a whole lot
too zen for me.
but usually what will happen is, I mean, we've observed tight teams and clients, they sort of get some information, they think they see something, and then they jump straight to coming up with scenario writing. And the problem is that that's a good way to follow the shiny instead of paying attention to what the trend is.
Yes.
So the purpose of this is to identify trends, but in my world, trends are never trendy. So, and that's a really important thing to keep in mind. For me to describe a trend, you know, it could take a sentence. It usually doesn't have a cool tagline or a cool, it's not a cool catchphrase, you know?
Right.
Anyhow,
so you have to be suspicious if it's too shiny and too sexy.
Yeah.
That's too easy. That's the mind leapt to that because that lizard mind you're talking about went, that one.
That's right. Okay. Or ignoring some, you know, and then you want to do this with another person because somebody, you may not want to see something that's there.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And somebody else might say, wait a minute, I think I'm seeing this, right? So the first three steps describe what, and the second three steps describe what to do about it. So the fourth one is, where are you on the timing of this thing? And that's where you look at how is the technology or the science developing, but what are all these external events, right? So we talked about Uber earlier, what's happening with the technology, but then what's happening with this Arianna Huffington and
right.
Travis
and Jeffrey
what's
Holder
going on.
And all. But, you know, this is extraordinarily hard. Somebody said the future is simultaneously just around the corner and way farther out than we think. It's very hard to figure out a timeline, isn't it?
It is. But again, that's why you don't like, we get asked all the time for companies to like, tell us what this looks like in 100 years. And that's and I tell them like, I could, but I'm not going to be right. And that's a big waste of your money.
We're all going to be dead anyway.
You know,
can make up anything.
Well, you know? Conversely, so Stanford has a really good 100-year AI project, but that's different. They're not saying in 2017 what AI will look like in 2117. They're saying we want to study this over a long period of time.
Yeah.
People will die in the process, right? Because they'll get old. But we're gonna release information and we're gonna commit to really studying this. So that's different. Yeah, and it's a great and I strongly recommend everybody watching and listening to read what's there. It's very smart stuff, and you don't have to be a computer scientist to understand it.
You could Google AI 100 and find it.
Yeah, it's a good project. So anyhow, you figure out timing, and you're looking at things like how is the technology developing, but you're looking at these external events. And once you've sort of figured that out, then the next step is the fifth step, which is the fun part that everybody associates with futurists, which is come up with all the crazy scenarios for how this might unfold. For us, we do this and I explain this in great detail in the book. We do this using different, what I call emotive framings. So if you're feeling optimistic, pragmatic, pessimistic, or catastrophic, let's come up with all the different ways that we see this unfolding. And, you know, we may wind up with 100 different scenarios, for example. We just keep going until we've exhausted all possibilities. And we're looking at, you know, what is possible, what is plausible, you know, meaning further out in time, lots more questions, but we're not breaking the laws of nature. But then we say, laws of nature break all the time. Right? Turns out the world's not flat. Turns out we have gravity. So who am I to say that teleportation, that my body can't disintegrate and reappear somewhere else 100 years from now? You know, I don't know. So we even make those sorts of scenarios. And then we assign probabilities, again, based on evidence and data.
You're diligent.
but again, I'm not... My job is not to stand on a stage somewhere and delight and awe people with crazy.
This is not TED.
Well, no, but again, like this takes work. But if you do it, you're making smarter decisions.
Yes.
And I know it's a pain in the ass to go through all the steps.
I don't know if it's completely a pain in the ass. I think each step is fun. It just seems like the first step is the hardest because you've got to gather a lot of information. And as you say, you can't just read the summary. You need to read the whole article.
That's right. But I will tell you, I have been wrong once in my entire career doing this. And the only thing that I've ever been wrong about was NFC. And the mistake that I made was misinterpreting some patents and some agreements that I had read. I thought that NFC was going to be in the iPhone 4. And we told a client, I feel like there's a high probability of NFC being in the iPhone 4, you know, and in that case, and we always say there's possibilities for error.
Right.
And in case I was wrong and the client made an investment and that was a mistake that I caused.
Wow, so, you're taking a lot of responsibility. I would have just glossed that one over, put that one under the rug.
Well,
but by the way,
parents.
It should have been in the iPhone 4. It was hard to predict Apple's recalcitrance over NFC. And to this day, they still do not give NFC its full due, in my opinion. But that's, I mean, there's one thing to read the reports, and I guess the patents might have told you what Apple's baleful gaze was pointed. But you also can't predict humans, and there's emotions in this. It's a little less, since Steve's gone, it's not so, probably so emotional. But when Steve was doing this, and he was at this time, tomorrow he could say, yeah, I don't think so. On no basis at all. And how are you going to know that?
So that is the answer to the question. Why do, you know, we live in a world with AI. Why don't we just have an algorithm make all these predictions?
Because we're human.
That's right. Well, because humans are capricious.
Yeah.
And we oftentimes act out of emotion. And something as stupid and simple as NFC should be in the, you know, there should have been an NFC in the phone. For whatever reason, it wasn't. But it probably had more to do with
Steve.
People and technology. Right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. It should have been in the phone. I would have bought into that right away. Hey, we're talking to Amy Webb. This is so great. I wish we had 5 hours with you, but I guess you can spend a few hours with the book. The Signals Are Talking by Amy Webb. It is just a fun read, but it's also a methodology for figuring out what's really happening and in a deep way, not in a shallow, trendy TED Talk way. Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. We'll have more. I want to ask you, I know you don't, well, it sounds like you do actually deal with individual companies. I'm going to ask you about a few companies and what you see coming. I know this is putting you on the spot a little bit, but you're thinking about this all the time. We just cover it. Amy Webb is our guest. The Signals Are Talking. Our show today talking about another disruption. Maybe you saw this one coming. Anybody went to a drugstore to buy a razor blade 10 years ago, saw it coming. They lock them up like it's precious gold. And actually, if you look at the price, it is. The razor blade companies had figured it all out. We give away the razor. It's even a saying. We give away the razor and we make it up in the blades. We charge you for the blades. So here we are in the internet era. What's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to disrupt that, aren't you? And if you're two guys, the guys who founded Harry's, Jeff and Andy, good friends, and they saw this and they said, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if instead of razor blades locked up in the drugstore, you know, at $8 or a blade, what if we did mail order and we did it direct from the factory and we made it affordable and easy? Wouldn't we completely disrupt this business? And they did. And they created Harry's. They're fixing shaving. And it's just an awesome story. They actually, doing their due diligence, realized the best thing they could do was buy the factory. They bought the factory in Germany that makes the blades. So now you're buying direct from the factory. Harry's is incredible. A great shave at a great price. The convenience of coming to you, it's awesome. Harry's razors include everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. The handles are, you know, it's everything that the other guys do. Weighted and ergonomic handles. You get the cartridges with five precision engineered blades, and you get the lubricating strip. You even get the trimmer blade, you know, that gets right under your nose there. They also, in your kit, will sell you a rich lathering shave gel or the shave cream, which I actually like better. But, you know, you get your choice. You get the travel blade cover. In fact, this is the kit you can get for $15. And I gave this to my son for Christmas, actually. But Harry's is so confident that you will love this, they're going to get you a shave set free. You just cover the shipping, a couple of bucks shipping. And you'll be started. You'll have the blade. You'll have the razors. You'll even have the shave cream, and you could try it. And it's so easy to do. Just go to harrys.com/triangulation. harrys.com/triangulation. There's no reason you should be paying those inflated prices for the drugstore blades when you can get it from Harry's. A great shave at a fraction of the price. harrys.com/triangulation. Good example there, actually, of... if you're an entrepreneur looking, this is the same kind of prediction is useful for you looking for a business that you can easily or in an interesting way disrupt, and I'm sure that's why people come to the the Future Today Institute to get the advice of Amy Webb and her colleagues. Amy is our guest. The book is The Signals Are Talking. Everybody's talking about augmented reality, AR. You agree? This is the next big thing?
You know, everybody, I think I hear more people talking about VR.
Well, I think you're wrong on VR because I've tried it and it's boring.
Well, okay.
It's a gaming technology.
Yeah, so I agree with you.
Good.
But for a slightly different reason. So I especially see everybody in news, you know, moving to VR as like the next big platform that they can monetize. And the challenge is if you stop and think about when you would use VR and when we consume news, even fabulous news video or documentary style video, you know, I'm not going to ride the subway in New York with wired in.
It was interesting when the New York Times distributed Google Cardboard and they did those tales of children refugees of war. It was very interesting, but I didn't see a future for that. It's too hard.
Right. I mean, I think it makes sense for entertainment verticals. So, you know, and I got to play with this very, very cool experimental. It was a Sony experiment, but basically you wear you wear a VR head-mounted display, but you actually see the real world, and you do this with three other people, and you see their perspective. So you wind up with a split screen of the real world that's around you, but you see your perspective and their perspectives as well.
That sounds disorienting.
it was for a couple seconds, but then I spent a lot of time playing computer games, so I'm
okay.
That is probably already being used in warfare, I would think.
Sure, that makes sense.
But, you know, from practical applications, you know, there are different ways to think about VR, but AR has many, many, many more practical applications. You know, and it doesn't require... And what's fascinating to me is, you know, so VR got its start as a therapeutic technology for people suffering from PTSD. So that's where VR originated.
And it has worked very well in that sphere.
That's right.
Yeah.
And AR originated inside of a factory. People were hand-drawing these blueprints in the 90s. It just got to a point where wouldn't it be easier for us to just overlay changes so we're not constantly having to redraw stuff? So they started out with very different uses, and we've gone through lots of different iterations, mostly with our phones. I think once we have an environment where we don't have to hold a device up to see that AR overlay, but instead it's just part of our glasses or a contact lens, you know, we'll start to see greater integration. But so again, people who blew off Pokemon Go as just flash in the pan and, you know, Nintendo's, you know, and the various players trying to stay relevant or whatever. To me, that was an important moment because it reintroduced AR and reminded people, oh, this is a way that we can use our devices.
That's exactly what I said. It was a wedge application for AR.
Yeah, for sure.
And I played it like incessantly for about 6 months and then got sick of it. So Apple, you know, everybody's saying, oh, it's going to be Apple's, which is fun. Apple, it's so funny because Apple is coasting on purely on reputation at this point because no one knows anything about Apple's AR plans. It's just, well, if it's Apple, it must be great. Like, oh, well, they'll figure this one out. And I'm not convinced, frankly, that I don't know who's going to figure this out. You talk about Magic Leap in the book a little bit.
Yeah. And again, so Magic Leap is another one of those hugely controversial companies because we haven't seen, you know, they're crazy talk about valuation and investments and money raised, and we haven't seen a device yet. So this brings up a good point, which is there's such a thing as basic research. Basic research is not research that's being done in pursuit of a single product. It's being done for the pursuit of knowledge. And I believe that is how they got their start. It had to do with can we pursue some completely different way of overlaying information? You know, that's why I think you haven't seen a product sprint and, you know... why maybe we haven't seen anything yet and the founders have been a little elusive and sometimes, you know, silly. There was a famous TEDx presentation where they pretended like they were walking on the moon. You know, so there's been some theater.
There's been some theater is a good description. I mean, almost deceptive.
That's right. But I will tell you, having read with a fine-tooth comb all of their patents and followed very closely some of the things that they're trying to build and work on, you know, it's too expensive and it takes too long to write that stuff and to file it and to go through all the paperwork and the hassle for them to not be serious about what they're building. So, you know.
Yes, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
It's clear they're serious. Absolutely. Whether they'll be able to do it is another matter. But
that's right.
They're shooting. It's a moonshot. So good. Let's have more moonshots. Nothing wrong with that.
That's right. And in a sense, it sort of doesn't matter whether or not they're successful because everybody, you know, lots of people have read those patents.
It only matters if you're one of the investors. It's not.
Well, that matters. Or an employee.
But we're not. Or an employee. But we're not.
And if you're taking this longer view,
right.
You can see how those patents have started to influence what other people are working on. And that's so it's observing those relationships versus, you know, and the same thing for Google Glass, which I used to have sitting right over here. Everybody loves to hate on Google Glass, you know, and it was probably an ill-fated commercial product from the get-go. But what did Google Glass do? It ignited interest in a whole bunch of startups who wanted to do something better. Right. It also bridged a relationship between technology and lens providers like Essilor.
Yep.
You know, and the future of AI doesn't just involve tech companies. It involves the companies that make this glass.
We will absolutely look back at Google Glass and said that was a foundational technology for what has happened since.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
As much as we and I mocked it, I bought it, but I mocked it. But it was clear that there was important work here. So, yeah, I think that this is your perspective is very different and very valuable, I think. You're not betting on a horse. You're betting on the race. You're not saying that Magic Leap's going to win, but you're going to say, but there is a very important race happening, and it's augmented reality.
That's right. And if you're carefully observing the race and you have a good book and you've got the right information, you know, it's great. You will then know if. You know, if that horse is going to take off anyways, because
right.
you will be observing everything in a different right. way. Yeah.
What's going on with Google? What's your take on Google?
Well, where to begin?
There's an example of a company that seemed like it has so many advantages and certainly has a big bankroll and seems to be having a hard time figuring out what to do with all that money.
That's right. So, one of the most important things, you have to look at, the technology. If you're trying to figure out the future of the internet, I guess what I'm saying is you have to look at HTML5 and LiDAR, how things are developing. But the people who manage the companies, I'm a firm believer in science and technology will progress.
Yes.
They will progress.
Yes.
But the, the speed... And the speed with which they progress and how much they branch out and all of those other things are very much shackled to humans. And at some point in the distant future, technology will create itself, right? But we're not quite there yet. So Google had a bunch of management changes. What was it, like 18 months ago or 2 years ago now?
Yeah.
You know, and they've had some – and they changed their Google X division.
Yeah.
That's right. So part of this could just be, it's a huge company. Every time that I've been to their New York and their offices in the Valley, my favorite thing about Google is that nobody ever knows where anything is. Right.
That sounds about right.
Right. Like nobody ever knows, like they know that they know we're meeting in this room and I go like, and then we can never find it.
That's right? Why they invented Project Tango. Where am I?
Right.
That sounds exactly right. That in a nutshell, that's a great metaphor.
That's right. And I think that again, from my take on this, I think that Larry and Sergey have their sort of close-knit team of people, right? I forget what they have a name for it. It's their inner group.
Yeah, that executive board or the gang of eight or whatever. Yeah.
That's right. And I think that they've really relied on those folks to make strategic decisions and to operate, you know, in a way that's best for the company. But I don't sense there being a lot of direct, no micromanagement or a lot of direct directions or anything. And I think what that winds up causing is a lot of people just don't know what's going on.
Right.
So in this reorganization process, it could just be that they need some extra time to circle the wagons.
I'll give them time.
I don't know.
I love them as a company. In fact, it's because I love them as a company that I'm kind of frustrated with them as a company, because I'm all in on all of these technologies and they keep killing them and changing them. And I was hoping you knew, but I guess no one knows.
Are you feeling similarly about Apple?
No, Apple I've given up on.
Yeah.
Which is sad. Because I was a huge Apple fan, and I still am, but I think it's time to say it's over. Yeah. But it was nice. It was nice run. And by the way, it's not over if you're an Apple stockholder. It's only just begun. But as an Apple consumer, I'm a little disappointed with the direction the company's taken. Now, here's one thing we agree on. You say Westworld is the best television show ever made.
I agree.
So I find that interesting because as a futurist, you're looking at the future that Westworld's talking about and saying that's plausible?
No, that's not. And I should have clarified this. I should also clarify that I watch an inordinate amount of television.
So do I. I feel like guilty about that. I watch all those, you know, we're at the peak, you know, the golden age of TV, the platinum age, the peak TV. And there's some amazing stuff being done by Netflix and HBO and... Yeah, so okay, it's okay, right?
Yeah, I even watch Real Housewives.
I don't go that far.
I watch it all. Real Housewives.
I don't know if you have time. You're reading patent filings. How do you have time to do that?
I don't sleep. anyhow, so I don't. So here's why I like Westworld, and I definitely should have clarified that. This.
Well, you say a triumph of futurism, creativity, and philosophical thought.
So a couple of reasons why. I think that their approach to thinking through the implications of AI are rooted in data.
That's interesting.
You know, it's clear to me that they've done research, because a lot of the explanations for things and the way that things are unfolding are not, I would not say that are their original thought. They come from stuff that I see being built and worked on. So I love that. I also love the fact that nothing is, you know, you have to plug yourself in and pay attention and think about what's happening. And there is never a moment where they stop. And I was just watching something with my husband. We were just watching something and they like stopped. It was some other show. And they stopped in the middle of it and went over to the black, like they wrote in this scene where somebody's standing at a blackboard to explain it.
Like, that's not a good, usually not a good sign in a show.
No. No, and so the fact that
I hate exposition.
Yeah.
There was very little. Christopher Nolan is not an exposition. Jonathan Nolan, I should say, is not an exposition guy.
And the showrunners, so his name gets thrown a lot, but Lisa Joy is the other showrunner, and she's a woman, and we don't have a lot of women in Hollywood who are working on stuff like this.
Yep.
And so a lot of the protagonists are women, which is something that gender politics aside, it's just nice to see some, different and points of view.
Maeve is a fantastic character, I think.
Maeve is awesome. Did you see what they, this is not, I don't know if this is going to spoil anything or not.
They were at an event the showrunners were at PaleyFest, and they were teasing season 2, but I think they were pretty good about not saying anything.
No, I was more saying for people who haven't watched all the way through.
Oh,
on
if you
one.
Haven't watched it. Yeah, no, don't say anything, because I think there are people who are listening now who are going to say, or are saying, oh, I should have watched that.
Yeah, so I love this show so much that I would never dream of spoiling it. But it has to do with sort of Maeve getting woke and why. That point of self-actualization, I thought was just, and that's what got explained at PaleyFest, and I thought it was just lovely and awesome.
Ashville has an article. It's actually referred to as your tweet.
Yeah, that's
right. And if people don't show it on the screen if people want to read it.
Yeah, no.
But I like you did it perfectly. Maeve got woke. And why?
Literally,
Literally. What a great book. And I wish we had more time to talk to you, but you can spend some time with the book. The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. forecast and take action on tomorrow's trends today. Amy Webb, the author. She's the founder of the Future Today Institute, futuretodayinstitute.com. And if you want to hire her and make your business do a better job of facing the disruption we're all facing, that's where you should go. Future. And they have a good 2017 trends talk to a slide deck that you
can take a look at. Yeah, every year it's our 10th anniversary of the trend report. That's free. Anybody can download it. And our site's going to look different next week. It doesn't look good right now.
I think it looks perfectly great.
Oh, it looks awful. Can I share one Easter egg that I don't think I've ever talked about publicly?
Yeah.
So the book, the cover of the book, has some computer code in the binoculars.
It does, and in the binoculars,
The Easter egg, it's an Easter egg, and that is that it's a machine learning algorithm. So it's AI. Which is nobody. I've never. So there you go. The secret is out.
AI code in. I'm going to send this to John Graham Cumming. He collects code snippets from TV and movies and has a tumble log on that. Oh, that's good.
So juicy. and some clever readers have said, wait a minute, is that what I think that is?
Amy, where do you stand on the singularity?
Here's again, I think that we are there's no question to me that because of how we have to train machines to think on their own, which is what we're trying to do, that at some point, you know, they will then develop a language and move beyond us, and sort of there will be an us and a them. There's no question about that is what we're headed towards. But I think trying to assign a time frame to that is dangerous, because we wind up again. Right. The reason that we wound up in an AI winter is because a lot of these early promises never happened.
That's right.
So I'm pragmatic.
But there are little samples. It's happening. Google's got these AIs that actually created a new language, intermediate language, so they could translate. There's some things are starting to happen. They are starting to communicate with one another.
They are. And again, we can sit back. So, like, let me put on my Steve Mnuchin like hat. And, you know, I could deny that it's happening, right? And you know, how does that serve anybody? But I'm not one of those techno utopian optimists who says this is going to save everything and we're all going to live forever, right? The most important preparation for the future is critical, rational thought. That is, you know, making yourself think critically about the information you're seeing is the best possible way to future-proof yourself and your company. And that's probably the most important thing. And that's, I think, the most important, you know, point in the book that I make as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Our show is Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1900 UTC. I'm sorry, it's now 1800 UTC because we're in summertime. Please stop by and watch live. You're the important third side of that triangle. Our chat room, irc.twit.tv. But if you can't watch live, we do make it available on demand. In fact, I know there are people watching and listening in airplanes right now and all over the world on their iPhones and their Android phones. It's easy enough to get the on-demand version. Just go to twit.tv/TRI or subscribe in your favorite podcatcher, and that way you won't miss an episode. There's always great stuff to learn and think about and chew on Triangulation. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.